I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest is Amy Spitalnik, CEO of the JCPA, the Jewish Council for Public Affairs. We'll also have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. I returned last week from a whirlwind rabbinic visit to Azerbaijan and Israel with the Zionist Rabbinical Coalition, 10 days packed with meetings, visits, briefings, discussions, and travel. It was an exceptionally interesting experience and completely packed. Discounting 2 days it took to travel to Baku and 1 day flying home from Tel Aviv, we had 4 incredible days in Azerbaijan, followed by 2 spectacularly full days in Jerusalem, and 1 more in the Gaza envelope area in the south of Israel. The journey felt more like a month than a week, and it was productive and valuable in so many different ways. The meetings and briefings for the rabbis throughout the trip were at a very high level, including extended visits with both countries' respective ambassadors, with prominent members of parliament in both countries, as well as government ministers in charge of major departments. We met with perhaps the most important advisor to President Eliav in Azerbaijan. We met with the U.S. Chargé d'Affaires in Baku, outside experts in both countries, and then with Israeli soldiers and IDF representatives and other key personnel in the current situation in Gaza. In Azerbaijan, we also went to both of the Jewish day schools in Baku, prayed and enjoyed Shabbat with all 3 of the active congregations that flourish within just a few blocks of each other. In fact, 2 share a building constructed by the government for the Jewish community, each with its own separate, beautiful sanctuary. We traveled to the all-Jewish village in the mountains. It was the homeland area for many of the Azerbaijanian mountain Jews. In Israel, we spent time at the foreign ministry, visited the Knesset and the new Knesset Museum, had meetings in both places, had extensive meetings and discussions on the subject of how Israel is trying to grapple with worldwide anti-Semitism now and how best we as rabbis can address the rising tide of anti-Semitism and the generational divide we are all experiencing in support for Israel. It was quite the journey. At times, it felt like we were on a formal state visit of important dignitaries, whether we rabbis ever qualify for that or not. Now, mind you, when I told people I was going on a Zionist rabbinic coalition mission to Azerbaijan and Israel, the most common reaction was, "Where is Azerbaijan?" Like most of you, I had very little idea as to even where it's located and why it might be interesting or important in the contemporary Jewish world, or involved in any way in the life of Israel. I had a great deal to learn. There is much to explain and explore about this Shia Muslim nation that is so far from us in America that its time zone is a full 11 hours later than my hometown of Tucson, 2 hours beyond Israel's time zone. A former republic of the Soviet Union, Azerbaijan today is a first world oil-rich country. Its capital city of Baku is impressive. Magnificent ultra-modern architecture, restored early 20th century mansions, state-of-the-art museums, a wonderful old town dating back to the 12th century, terrific boardwalk along the beautiful Caspian Sea. It even has an ancient Zoroastrian fire temple, which I managed to add onto the itinerary and visit, discovering it has also been a worship site for Hindus and Sikhs. It's very cool, especially since I personally have long specialized in experiencing every holy place of every religion on the whole planet. Azerbaijan in ancient Persian means something like land of fire worshippers, and here indeed they were that. The emblem of the country and many of its spectacular new buildings take the form of flames. But today Baku is a modern city, clean and safe, with excellent roads, beautiful, well-maintained parks, especially when compared to our own American cities these days. Now that I've seen it, I definitely want to go back. Baku is great. But we American rabbis were not in Azerbaijan to enjoy the tourist sites. This small nation of 10 million in the Caucasus has the distinction of being the largest Shiite Muslim nation with full diplomatic relations with Israel. It has a Jewish community dating its origins to First Temple times, perhaps 2,700 years ago. Our rabbinical group was in Baku to affirm on behalf of Zionist American rabbis our support for Azerbaijan's close and positive connections with Israel, and to find out more about a nation that might serve as a model for how a 95% Muslim country can establish a warm, mutually supportive bilateral relationship with Israel, can have no anti-Semitism, according to everyone, and to interact with and learn about its active Jewish community. When we traveled on to Israel, that part of our mission was to see the Israeli perspective on Azerbaijan, among other things. There were some well-thought-out parallel experiences on our trip. We had a wonderful meeting and dinner at the home of the Israeli ambassador to Azerbaijan, Ronan Krauss. He will be a guest on Too Jewish soon. And in Jerusalem, we enjoyed a similarly warm and open discussion and dinner with the Azerbaijani ambassador to Israel, Mukhtar Mamadov. Azerbaijan has many similarities to Israel, especially in one aspect. It, too, is located in a very, very tough neighborhood. Azerbaijan borders Russia to the north and east, Iran to the south, and Armenia, its long-time enemy, both to the north and west, and is a kind of inserted territory between the main part of Azerbaijan and the Karabakh region. Its friendliest neighbor is Turkey. Now that's a tough neighborhood indeed, quite comparable to Israel's challenges. There are no open borders now between Azerbaijan and its neighbors. They have gone to great pains in Azerbaijan to prevent Iranian mullahs from crossing into Azerbaijan, spreading their doctrines of Shiite Islamist extremism. It has developed a strong and independent military without receiving substantial help from the West, or at least from the U.S. Israel, however, has provided substantial support. We were often told of the gratitude Azerbaijan feels to the Jewish state for that support. There is a strong commercial relationship, too, with Israel. Oil and gas, mostly oil these days, Israel has a lot of natural gas, flows by pipeline through Turkey to ports and then is shipped to Israel, which receives most of its oil these days from Azerbaijan. Israel, in turn, exports technology and high-tech talent and skills to Azerbaijan, as well as some of its substantial military expertise. When we asked whether Azerbaijan was planning on joining the much-publicized Abraham Accords, we were told by everybody in Baku, members of the Azerbaijanian parliament, heads of important committees and departments, the principal security advisor to the president, the Israeli ambassador, the U.S. chargé d'affaires, everybody said the Abraham Accords would be a major downgrade in the Azerbaijanian-Israel relationship. Both countries accord the other full diplomatic relations and have highly capable ambassadors in place for a number of years. There is already substantial trade between the countries, exchanges of delegations, business people from both nations and the other country, tourism, and significantly close cooperation on intelligence, especially regarding their mutual enemy, Iran. While nobody would substantiate it officially, there are rumors that the intelligence that allowed Israel to strike the Iranian missile and nuclear sites was spirited out through Azerbaijan. It's important to understand that Iran and Azerbaijan both have populations made up primarily of Shia Muslims. They share many cultural similarities and traditions. And yet Azerbaijan is much closer diplomatically, militarily, commercially to Israel, a nation that is 80% Jewish and has very few Shia Muslims. Israeli Arabs are either Sunni Muslims, Christians, or Druze. This is highly significant and is recognized as such by Azerbaijanis and Israelis. A Muslim country, officially secular, with separation between religion and state, but still 95% Muslim, can indeed have an excellent relationship with Israel, one that is clearly mutually beneficial and leads to improved security and prosperity for both nations. Is this a valuable model for other Muslim world countries considering improving diplomatic relations with Israel? Well, A few days in Baku certainly made the possibility of other nations developing this kind of relationship with Israel seem likely, or at least not beyond facile imagination. Azerbaijan already has that relationship. There are more than 20 nonstop flights between Baku and Tel Aviv every week. Why would it not also be possible for other Muslim nations to imitate its success, connecting both with Israel and with the rest of the Islamic world? There are clearly mutual benefits for both countries, a fact emphasized repeatedly by everybody we spoke with, both in Azerbaijan and at the Israeli Foreign Ministry. You know, in our recent weekly Torah portions in synagogue, we see the initial and longer-term estrangement of two brothers, Jacob and Esau. In a way, it often feels like that between the Jewish and Muslim worlds, sibling hostility that has degenerated to terrible and profound violence. But this visit brought to me the hope that reunification of family that has occurred between a Shiite Muslim nation, Azerbaijan, and a deeply Jewish nation, Israel, can serve as a true model of peace and cooperation for the future of the Middle East. And who knows? If Jews and Muslims can live in peace, why can't the whole world? To play us in this morning on the theme of peace, here's the Israeli classic song Shir LeShalom, a song of peace. That was Shiri Maimon singing Shir LeShalom. You may remember that song is always associated with the late Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, whose 30th yard site took place last month, the remembrance of his murder. He was assassinated with that very song, Shir LeShalom, the song of peace in his pocket, after it was sung at a rally for the peace process. We return in a moment here on Two Jewish. Our guest this morning will be Amy Spitalnik, CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the JCPA, a venerable mainstream organization that strives for consensus for Jews on addressing issues facing the American Jewish community in America. Meet Amy Spitalnik when she joins us in a moment here on Two Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Amy Spitalnik is the CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the JCPA, which is a mainstream convener of national Jewish coalitions working across kind of all community lines, working on building a just and inclusive American democracy. I think that's the wording that you guys use. She has worked against anti-Semitism in a variety of previous jobs, executive director of Integrity First for America, and has extensive experience in government, politics, and advocacy, among other areas. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thanks so much for having me.
So please explain, we've had JCPA leaders on here before, but it's been a while. Can you explain to our listeners just what the Jewish Council for Public Affairs is?
Absolutely. JCPA has been around for 81 years, founded in 1944 at a really dark moment in Jewish history when Jews here were quite literally trying to bang down the White House door to get them to pay attention to what was happening to European Jewry, and failing, and recognize that the only way Jews would be safe here and around the globe was to build deep coalitions and relationships across communities so that we would strengthen our political power and our ability to advocate for our own safety and for the rights and safety of all. And that's been at the core of the work JCPA has done for 81 years. We co-founded the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights with the NAACP. I'm, you know, proudly a board member of the Leadership Conference today, the preeminent National Civil Rights Coalition. We've advocated for Soviet Jewry and for Israel and for so much more throughout our long history. And in this moment right now, when we're seeing record levels of anti-Semitism, as well as broader threats to our democracy and to the safety of so many communities, our work feels existential. And at the core of what we do is the recognition that there is no truly inclusive, pluralistic democracy unless Jews are safe and protected. And so too do we as Jews require inclusive, pluralistic democracy for our own safety, that our safety and rights are deeply tied to the safety and rights of all communities, to our democratic norms and the rule of law, and to the health and vibrancy of our society and our democracy.
I've heard it said probably a variety of times, Jews are the canary in the coal mine, an analogy that may mean less in an era of electric cars, but still that when something's going wrong, Jews are the first ones to be hit, for example. This feels like a dark period now. In your experience, would you define it as such?
Absolutely. Look, the last decade in particular has really illustrated both how anti-Semitism and attacks on Jews are so often the canary in the coal mine, and how our safety really is deeply tied to the safety of all. And so confronting broader hate and extremism requires us to confront the anti-Semitism that's so often at the core of these conspiracy theories and extremism. So whether it's Charlottesville, the attack, the Unite the Right violence, which is something that I spent years of my life focused on in my prior capacity leading an organization where we brought a thankfully successful lawsuit against the neo-Nazis who attacked Charlottesville, at the core of their hate was anti-Semitism. They chanted, "Jews will not replace us in blood and soil." They surrounded the local synagogue with semi-automatic weapons, chanting Sieg Heil. And at the core of their bigotry and hate was this idea that Jews were this all-powerful entity, undermining our country, changing our demographics, and ultimately undermining the broader worldview that they had for a, you know, white Christian nation. And so we see how over and over again anti-Semitism is really at the core of this broader extremism and hate. After Charlottesville, we saw a cycle of violence that started with Charlottesville and the attack on a Pittsburgh Tree of Life congregation, which was the deadliest attack on the Jewish community in U.S. history, followed by the attack at the Poway Chabad a few months later. And then that summer in El Paso, Texas, targeting the Latino community, in Buffalo, New York, targeting the Black community, in Christchurch, New Zealand, because this is a global crisis targeting the Muslim community. And at the core of all of these attacks were these same anti-Semitic, racist, and xenophobic conspiracy theories. So anti-Semitism doesn't simply threaten Jews, it threatens all of us. And now, of course, post-October 7th, we're seeing these same tropes and conspiracy theories of Jewish or Zionist control and power of our government, of our finances, of our foreign policy, or whatever it may be, being used to not just pit communities against one another and otherize and marginalize Jews, but ultimately to fuel real-world violence, as we've seen in the firebombing of Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's home, the horrific shooting outside the Capitol Jewish Museum, and the attack on the peaceful walk for the hostages in Boulder, Colorado. And so, again, these conspiracy theories, at its core, anti-Semitism is a conspiracy theory around these tropes of Jewish control and power. And so it is intended to pit us against others, to sow distrust and division in our institutions and our democracy. And it tells us that it doesn't just threaten Jews, but it fundamentally threatens all communities and our democracy itself.
We will talk much more with Amy Spitalnik, the CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this fall and winter. Established 7 years ago by terrific congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. Religious schools available for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us for Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience for the youngest kids, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Join us for Congregation Beit Simcha's 7th anniversary celebration Saturday night, December 20th at 5 p.m. Let there be light. Music, latkes, food, drink, fun, and of course menorah lighting. Wonderful, delicious catering by Catalina Caterers. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up for the finest Hanukkah celebration in all of Arizona. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come Friday night for services at 6:30 p.m. in person or on our Facebook page. We always broadcast on Facebook Live. That's at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Services at 10 a.m., including Torah study, always followed by a Kiddush. You can also come to services on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes, ranging from Kabbalah to Introductory Judaism, are live and on Zoom. You can access those through the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website, toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's a very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. All those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields.
You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week, we started talking and talked extensively about the kind of three different cultures, civilizations, major civilizations that have been vying for leadership of the Middle East for a long time, the Persian civilization, the Arab civilization, and the Turkic civilization. You had some other insights about that. Love to hear them.
Okay. First of all, a tiny correction to what you just said. It's not only the Middle East. Turkic civilizations go all the way into East Asia. And certainly nobody will consider Kyrgyzstan or Tajikistan to be part of the Middle East, but they are definitely in or adjacent to Turkic countries. That's just a technicality, but the civilizational concept that we talked about last week is in the Middle East, but it goes beyond that. What I want to talk about this week is something that's more limited to the Middle East, and it is the root of most of the problems in today's Middle East. And it's called the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which for some reason is not very well known in the U.S. Maybe it's the way we teach history, but...
Or don't teach history, as the case may be.
Right. During the early years of World War I, when the French and the Brits, of course, were allies, and the Ottoman Empire was the enemy. They were allied with Germany. But clearly, the Ottoman Empire was crumbling. And these big colonial powers, namely France and the UK, wanted to be in control of how the Ottoman Empire was carved up after the war. But long before the peace conferences that followed World War I, and there were a bunch of them, many of which produced very controversial results that are the seeds of contemporary conflicts. But even before those peace conferences, two relatively junior diplomats in Paris and London, the Brit was named Sykes, the Frenchman was named Picot, who had never set foot in the Middle East and really didn't know much about it, took out maps and drew lines quite arbitrarily. And those lines determined the shape, the borders, and many of the conflicts between countries in today's Middle East. This is well before the Balfour Declaration. This was sort of colonialism at its worst, its most culturally insensitive, and its most ignorant. But there's just a long list of conflicts in today's Middle East that stem from this agreement and the map that was created by these two guys. Now, there are obviously other sources of conflict in the Middle East. It's not all due to this. But this plays an outsized role. And if you look at the way Britain dismantled its colonial empire and abandoned places that it once ruled, like India, they did a dramatically terrible job of separating India from Pakistan and the Muslim civilizations there from the Hindu civilization.
Yeah, incredibly bad. Just
the job they
bad.
Did and the maps they drew has generated...
nonstop war, more or less.
Right. So, I mean, the Middle East is not the only region that's impacted by this, but it was basically the same process of people who were ignorant of conditions on the ground, looking at maps and deciding what suited their imperial interests, and with no care at all towards long-term peace or stability or nation building. At least traditionally in U.S. foreign policy, we've paid more than lip service to the goals of nation building and stability and peace in the region and development and stuff like that. That was not the case 100 years ago. And what you see in today's Middle East owes an incredible percentage to this terrible agreement between the Brits and the French. If anybody among your listeners is interested in reading more about this, there's a wonderful book called A Peace to End All Peace by a guy named David Fromkin.
Yeah, it's great. Unfortunately, it's great.
It's worth reading, and it gives you a lot of insight into the roots of so many of today's conflicts.
I want to thank you, Tom, for a great review, a bad one, of the Sykes-Picot Agreement and how it continues to contribute to Tsourist. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. It's Berlin in the 1930s. Two old Jews are sitting on a park bench reading newspapers. One is reading the Yiddish paper. The other guy is reading Der Stürmer, the virulently anti-Semitic German newspaper. The first guy reading the Yiddish paper asks the other guys, Moshe, how can you read that Nazi rag? The second guy answers, Yankel, you see, it's like this. When I read the Yiddish press, it's all about Jews being deported, insulted, assaulted, murdered. When I read the German Nazi paper, the news is we Jews own the banks, we run the movies, we own the media, we control everything. I feel so much better. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you, you should live and be well. You know, unfortunately, it feels a little bit like those days have returned. And now a word of Torah. What makes a man an adult? How do we know when he moves from youthful immaturity to become a grown-up, a man in full? This week's Torah portion of Vayishlach focuses on the guy who is the true father of our nation, Jacob, and the way in which he becomes Israel. Throughout his colorful life until now, Jacob has been less than a full man. Oh, he's attractive to women. He has four wives by now, and he has been prolific, having produced 12 children. He's acquired wealth, too, cattle and sheep, livestock, real and valuable property. But he has also proven to be a manipulator, a trickster whose most important priority is always his own needs. And while he is a strong, able man, it's his brother Esau who was always the athlete, the hunter, the tough guy on the block. Jacob has never yet met a situation he will not try to manipulate to his own advantage, almost always at the expense of others, including his own immediate family members. Suddenly, admittedly, in the face of threatened destruction, Jacob realizes it is more important to him to save others than just to save himself again. You see, Jacob is returning to his homeland, Canaan, and approaching the border, the Jordan River, he is informed that his estranged and much wronged brother Esau is coming to meet him at the head of an army. Forced to face Esau, Jacob chooses to do perhaps the first altruistic act of his entire life. He tries to save his family before he saves himself. In fact, he divides his family into two camps and sends a rich present, a bribe, for Esau. And then he confronts his fears. Jacob gets up in the middle of the night, terrified of the coming encounter with his well-armed and well-accompanied brother, and Jacob goes alone to an island in the river. We don't know why he ends up in a famous wrestling match there in this tributary of the Jordan, this cage-fighting championship of Canaan. Nor do we know against whom he wrestles. We only know that here in the Torah, Jacob ultimately prevails at the cost of serious physical injury, a limp that will plague him the rest of his life. And we know that his name is changed to Israel, a name that becomes our name as a people, Am Yisrael, B'nai Yisrael, the people and children of Israel. The name of the land that will be ours, Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. Israel, which means one who wrestles with God. It is notable that Jacob in this encounter shows physical prowess, as we are taught that men should. But it is perhaps more noteworthy that Jacob demonstrates this prowess over someone other than a human opponent. In Vayishlach, Jacob overcomes, according to tradition, his own yetzer, his own nature, which has directed him towards selfishness and manipulation. Jacob comes, for the first time, a man in full. He rises to meet Esau, limping off to greet him. And when he does so with the deepest possible commitment to his children, his family, the future of his people. It is those commitments that mark how Jacob becomes an archetypal Jewish man, dedicated to the values that ultimately matter most. It is this moment, this transformative growth, that allows the brothers to surprisingly resolve their lifelong differences and reunite. In that transformation of our own natures, the ways in which we grow from adolescence to maturity, it is that that allows each of us to fulfill the commitments that we make. May we each learn from Jacob's struggles what it takes to truly be a man, a mensch. And may we demonstrate those great qualities and so go from strength to strength with integrity. We return in a moment on Two Jewish. Our guest, Amy Spitalnik, CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the JCPA, explains how her organization seeks to respond to the rising tide of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Find out how they are doing so when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
The remains of Dror Or, who was murdered by Palestinian terrorists on October 7, 2023, in the Hamas-led war crime attacks, and then had his body taken into Gaza, that body was returned to Israel last week. Dror Or, who was 48 years old, was killed October 7, 2023, by terrorists from the Palestinian Islamic Jihad at Kibbutz Be'eri, where he lived with his family and worked as a cheesemaker. His wife, Yonat, was also murdered during the attacks on the kibbutz. Their children, Noam and Alma, were taken hostage. The children were released in November 2023, exactly 2 years before Dror Or's remains were finally released. When the kids returned home 2 years ago, they found out their mother had been brutally murdered by the Palestinian terrorists, while their father remained a hostage in Gaza. He is gone. After 781 agonizing days during which his family fought day and night for him, Dror has been brought back to Israel for burial in the soil of Be'eri that he loved so dearly, wrote the Hostages and Missing Families Forum. There are no words to express the depth of this pain. Hostages have no time. We must bring them all home now. The forum also remembered Or as a wonderful cheesemaker who co-founded the Be'eri Dairy. His company's cheeses are now sold at Cafe Otef, an Israeli cafe chain featuring a selection of products from the communities that were attacked in the war crimes committed by the Palestinians on October 7, 2023. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad announced they found Or's remains last week. The Red Cross facilitated his transfer to the IDF. His remains were identified overnight in Israel. Or's release means there are just two deceased hostages who now remain in Gaza. Ron Gvili, a 24-year-old, was a police officer killed fighting against Hamas terrorists at Kibbutz Alumim, while Thai national Sudhisak Rinthlak, who was 43 years old, was murdered at Kibbutz Be'eri. The delayed release of the dead hostages has strained the ceasefire that was reached last month, calling for the release of all hostages. In recent weeks, as the first phase of the ceasefire deal stretched on, the new truce between Israel and Hamas has been tested. Israel struck Gaza after Hamas terrorists fired at Israeli soldiers. In keeping with the deal's terms, Israel has returned the bodies of 15 Palestinians after receiving Or's remains. In other news, the families of victims of Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack on Israel filed a lawsuit against the cryptocurrency fund Binance and its CEO, saying they facilitated over $1 billion in funding to the Hamas terror group and others behind the attacks. This latest lawsuit against Binance CEO Changpeng Zhao comes 1 month after he was pardoned by President Donald Trump for his November 2023 conviction violating anti-money laundering and sanctions laws. Zhao pled guilty. He had been sentenced to 4 months in prison. Binance paid more than $4.3 billion in fines. When asked about the pardon earlier this month on 60 Minutes, Trump distanced himself from Zhao and Binance, which struck a $2 billion deal with the Trump family's crypto venture last spring. "I don't know who he is," Trump said disingenuously of Zhao. "I know he got a 4-month sentence or something like that. I heard it was a Biden witch hunt." And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Amy Spitalnik is the CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the venerable JCPA, which has sought to advocate for, I guess I would say, mainstream Jewish positions and tried to find a balance. I want to talk about that a little bit in its history. Tell us a little bit about how the JCPA chooses the issues that it will advocate for in a particular period of time, and how that balancing act is conducted.
Well, you know, historically, up until a few years ago, JCPA really was involved in almost every policy issue you could imagine under the sun. And there's a fascinating policy compendium available on our website that really illustrates how through JCPA's work, we would have these amazing delegates assemblies where people would argue about policy into all hours of the night. And it was the closest thing to consensus policy in the Jewish community, 145 national and local Jewish organizations coming together to find consensus where possible on a whole host of domestic and foreign issues.
Which sounds like the largest herding of cats in the history of humanity.
That is one way to put it. And that is one of the many reasons, right? I think we have shifted to a different model that feels more relevant and nimble for the moment that we're in. In the year 2025, it's hard to imagine that there is consensus on anything in this country, right, let alone some of the most challenging policy issues of the moment. And while unity in the Jewish community, particularly post-October 7th, but more broadly, is key, unanimity is something that our community has never really had. You know, two Jews, three opinions, or whatever.
Four synagogues keep passing it on down. That's right.
Exactly. And so our work over the last few years has really taken the core ideas that drove the founding of JCPA, this idea that Jewish safety is deeply connected to the safety of all communities, to our democracy itself, and really focused in on those core issues at this moment when both anti-Semitism is rising in new and existential ways, and our democracy is facing new threats on a regular basis. So our work now is focused on how we counter anti-Semitism, broader hate and extremism, how we protect our democracy, including our voting rights, the rule of law, and so much more at a time when they are seeing real threats nationally and locally. And most importantly, how we mobilize Jews, of course, to show up for all of these issues, but also engage secular, interfaith, and other partners and allies in the civil rights, democracy, human rights and related spaces to understand anti-Semitism, to understand the urgency of protecting Jewish safety, and to show up as allies for us, just as we show up in coalition to advocate for all communities' rights.
Threats seem to be getting worse, right? And as a Jewish community, they seem to come faster and faster. You mentioned the JCPA is becoming more nimble. Tell us sort of how you guys decide when and where you're going to take on an issue and how you address that issue when you take it on.
Yeah. So, you know, we see our work in three key categories. First and foremost, on the national front, really looking at our policy advocacy and engagement through the lens of how are we countering anti-Semitism and broader hate and extremism, and how are we fighting to protect democracy? And as we've been talking about I see those issues as inextricably linked. And so rather than try to do everything under the sun, we really try to focus in on those points and places where we can have the most impact, whether it's in, for example, mobilizing a coalition of 10 mainstream Jewish organizations this spring, which included the Conservative Reform and Reconstructionist movements alongside a number of other partners and the rabbinic networks, to reject this false choice between Jewish safety and democracy at a time when we were seeing both real fears around anti-Semitism validated by increasingly violent hate targeting the Jewish community, as well as efforts by the federal government to exploit some of those fears to gut, you know, research funding at universities or undermine academic freedom and the broader rule of law and civil rights and liberties. We wanted to make clear that those dismissing the Jewish community's concerns were not right, and those exploiting the Jewish community's concerns to undermine broader democratic norms were also not right. And the vast majority of us, as the poll data has continually affirmed, can hold multiple truths at the same time, can believe that anti-Semitism is real and that threats to our democracy are real, and our fears are not an excuse to undermine those democratic norms and values that have been so important to our community's safety and advancement for so long. And so, for example, that was a moment where there really was a vacuum in terms of, you know, mainstream Jewish organizations speaking out. We were proud to lead this coalition. It got, you know, extraordinary attention, including being, you know, read into the record at multiple congressional hearings and cited by a coalition of Jewish U.S. senators who shared a similar letter. And so it matters for our community to find the moments where our voice can have the most impact, and that was certainly one of them. And we continue to look for those moments, whether it's in countering anti-Semitism in all of its forms, as we saw, you know, particularly post Boulder and Capital Jewish Museum, which is
horrible
yet another
stuff. Yeah.
You know, the flip side of pushing back against those exploiting our real concerns about anti-Semitism is also mobilizing partners to speak out against real anti-Semitism. And we were proud to bring together 65 civil rights groups, non-Jewish civil rights groups, Muslim, Arab, Latino, LGBTQ, Black, and others, to make clear that when Jews are targeted because of disagreement with Israeli policy, that's anti-Semitism, period. And a statement like that from such a broad coalition of civil rights groups, as we see increasingly violent anti-Semitism on the left, is enormously powerful.
It has always seemed to me that the best way to address anti-Semitism is continue to build positive and strong friendships and relationships across all religious and cultural lines. That's certainly what the JCPA has been doing. I guess a final question, maybe a very difficult one. People have been trying to make a very clear distinction between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. How does the JCPA respond to people who say, no, anti-Zionism is fine, that's not anti-Semitism?
Well, look, you know, as we talked about earlier, this debate in the Jewish community is one of the many that is, I think, you know, illustrating how we don't need consensus on everything, but what we need to do are find those baseline values where we can agree where real harm and danger is being caused. And so while in theory anti-Zionism is not inherently anti-Semitic, there are Jewish anti-Zionists, there are those who believe that, you know, there shouldn't be any sort of religious-based ethno-state. The vast majority of the ways that anti-Zionism is manifesting right now is inherently anti-Semitic. And so the way that we try to explain it is helping people actually understand what Zionism is, because most people don't even know what this term means.
Right.
For me, and I think for many Jews, it's simply the belief that Jews are entitled to self-determination somewhere in this place in the world where we have deep historic connections. And it goes hand in hand with my belief in Palestinian self-determination and dignity, that Jewish self-determination, Palestinian self-determination can actually and must actually coexist. And when the vast majority of Jews have a relationship with Israel, believe in the importance of a Jewish homeland, even if we don't agree with its government and its policies, which we know is true for so many American Jews or Israelis for that matter, that is Zionism to me. And when we're seeing those sorts of ideas or our Jewish identity being targeted through those effectively saying Zionists are not welcome in certain spaces, there should be banned or boycotted or otherwise not welcome, that becomes inherently, intentional or not, a form of anti-Semitic discrimination. And so it's important to help people understand the impacts, even if the intent isn't there, and give people grace to recognize that they might not even know what terms like Zionism mean in this moment. So many might think it simply means supporting the actions of the current Israeli government or the settlements or something like that. And so helping people understand what it means to the majority of American Jews, and then helping them understand the real impacts of some of this harmful and dangerous rhetoric or discrimination that we've seen become so normalized.
I want to thank Amy Spitalnik for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about the JCPA and your work?
You can visit jewishpublicaffairs.org. You can sign up for our action networks, which is how folks can take action on so many of the issues we've talked about, to get updates, to get engaged with our work. And of course, we work very closely with local partners around the country, Jewish community relations councils and others, Holocaust museums, JCCs. And so we are frequently in folks' communities around the country as well. And if you'd like us to come to one of yours, just reach out at jewishpublicaffairs.org.
Amy, thank you so much. Keep doing this great work. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Professor Alan Marinas, a good friend and founder of the Musar Institute and author of the new book, The Shabbat Effect. Join us at Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night. Services and owning Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Thanksgiving is over now, which means our next holiday is Hanukkah, believe it or not, coming up in just a little over 2 weeks, beginning December 13th. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the wonderful Festival of Lights. It's from Naomi Less. It's her fun, newish Hanukkah song, Eight Nights. Join us for Congregation Beit Simcha's 7th anniversary celebration, Saturday, December 20th, 5 o'clock p.m. Let there be light. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up for the best Hanukkah celebration in Arizona. My friends, happy end of Thanksgiving weekend. May you enjoy a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week, we pray profoundly, of peace.
Feel so right.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.